Hey, okay, Circus Peanut who ran with scissors. Got it. Oh, cool. Thank you very much. Now, the syllabi are up here. Like I say, we can do this without embarrassment. We'll do the every eye closed, every head bowed, raise your hand if you need a syllabus, if you left it at home kind of thing if we have to. So they're still here. We'll just leave them over there. Great, thanks. I have been, it's a delight to be here again today. I've been in bed for the last couple of days, and currently I'm on what they call, quote-unquote, severe cold/flu medicine. And I don't know whether the severe goes with medicine or with the cold. It's one of those. So if I act very linear this morning, you'll understand why. But in the couple of hours that I've been awake, I've been studying predation in nature, where the stronger preys upon the weak in nature, kind of thing for a piece I'm doing on the tank, and now I'm on the other end of that, being preyed upon by all these weaker, but they have ganged up like the Lilliputians, I suppose, and so I am just, so you'll have to bear with me, but the good news is when I am weak, he is strong, right? So let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we come before you, wanted to take a few minutes and reflect upon the awesomeness of what you actually did here in history in front of us. Just you bared your heart. You showed us what was important to you. You offered us some incredible warmth and aggressive kindness to us through the person of your Son. You gave us the clues and wrote it down in a little narrative about it so that we wouldn't have to grope around in the dark about this and understanding what it was, and that we could somehow approach your unadulterated love for us. We pray that as we wrap up today, as we look over what this was all about, that we would get a larger understanding, that we would get a glimmer, a greater glimmer of your heart in the process, and that we would get to know you, and that we would tap in more and more to the relationship with you, which that can feed and transform our entire lives. So we just ask that for your Son's sake, that we might honor him and what his heart did for us on that Friday so long ago. Amen. Well, we are on the next to the last, the next to the next to the last page of the syllabus. We're on page 15.
Anti-penultimate,
that's right. Okay, got it. That means that three back from the end. There's the ultimate, the penultimate, and the anti-penultimate, if you're doing Greek diachronic marks. But we'll come back to that in the second syllabus. We've got 12 lectures to do on anti-penultimate things in the fall. Now, what we've been studying, what we've been looking at for some 20-odd weeks in the past year, 22 weeks, I believe it's been, we have been looking at the sacrifice. We have been looking at what happened that Friday and the way God tried to understand that, the way God tries to get us to understand what happened that Friday on the cross. And we've looked at trying to see exactly what kind of images and word choices did he use to describe what Jesus did that afternoon. And the dominant one that was used was the word sacrifice. And we have scoured space and time for every obscure reference to sacrifice in ancient history. And we've come up with a basic knowledge that we all as human beings know that our relationship with God is broken and that something, it's costly somehow to repair it. It always takes something of value to repair it. In the older days, it was expressed in terms of perhaps agricultural sacrifice, animals, you know, livestock, whatever the currency of the day was, whatever the money was. In today's culture, most of our Western culture, it shows up in a different form. It shows up that I'm just not good enough to approach God, that I can't change my life enough, or I can't get holy enough inside, or I can't work up enough devotional attitude, or something of this type to approach this God. And we tend to, in our culture, give up a lot faster than they did there. They would go ahead and go to the flock and try anyway. But we just give up. We just say, there's no way. I'm not going to be able to do it. I think, one, perhaps the demands are heavier than I'm willing to bear. But in every sense, we know that there's something costly about this. It stops us from approaching God. We think it's going to hurt. It's going to be expensive, and it stops us. And the closest analog we have to that, of course, in personal relationships is that when we've offended somebody and you have to go make that apology. And you'll go, and you know it costs you something. There's always that leveling of the personas, leveling of the egos, the honesty that comes with that. And you don't have you're not negotiating from a strong position of strength when you approach in this way. But that's the closest analog we've got to the level of honesty that's required in approaching God. And he laid out something, the work, and we were right, by the way, our intuitions are corrected. It is costly to approach God. There has been a breach in history and space and time in our hearts and reality that does require work to repair. We are wrong in our intuitions that it's we who have to bear that. See? That's logically makes perfect sense. Since we broke it, we should fix it. Right? I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's just that as we get more honest about the fact that we just can't get there from here, we don't have it to do. We'll look at that today in our summary. It's there that we see that forms the backdrop for the fact that God broke into history and did that. And so it stands in stark relief to our puny efforts, or in many cases our misguided efforts to repair a relationship with God. The fact that God says, you got to quit fussing around this, I'm going to break in and take care of this for you. So that all you'll have to deal with is the apology side of it, the honesty side, and approach me in expectation of goodness as opposed to an expectation of judgment. In Hebrews, where it defines faith, it says, you know, it's got a little verse up there where it talks about the that approaches God must believe that God is, that's very obvious, and that he is a rewarder of those that seek him, that basically God's heart is good. And see, I can approach people, it's so much easier to approach people that I believe that they have good hearts and that they'll accept my apology and won't shame me for my behavior or my actions or things of this type. And that's a fundamental requirement of just being honest about God's heart, that he is good and is a rewarder of those that seek him out. And we are not necessarily consistent about how well we do this. Sometimes we run from God in our lives as Christians, as non-Christians. You know, we'll avoid God because we're still expecting rebuke. We're still expecting shaming. We're still expecting him to treat us like human persons have done on occasion. Right? And it's one of the challenges in our spiritual journeys to try to understand that and try to purify that and say, now, what data do I have to doubt God's goodness today? Do I have any reason at all, you know, on the basis of what he did at the cross, what he's done in my life, to taint his character in any way? You know, 470 years have I served him, and he has not done one thing wrong to me, the martyr said. Why would I deny him here at my death? Right? And so God builds what we call an audit trail of success with us. He's got that litany. He goes through it over and over and over. He answers our prayers. And For years, I had this little, my little prayer journal where I do the, you know, we ask, he answers thing. And when I get in the darkest of moments, you know, and I'll go back to this list over 15 years where the things I prayed for, you know, the ones that counted, they were there. And I'd sit there and say, and I stole that idea from the psalmist. When the psalmist got in trouble, he said, I will remember the years at the right hand of the Most High. And he'd go through what God did for Israel. Remember, King of Bashan, all these names and things. He'd go through this. And he'd sit there and say, so what evidence do I have that God is unfaithful? None. No voices. Just a little nagging doubt and anxiety of the moment. And then I've got a litany of successes. And so God broke into history and gave us one of these major visible images in the person of his son. And this access under the notion of sacrifice is what we're trying to wrap up today. So we are on F. We have gone through everything. We looked at the way Greeks looked at it, the way the Romans looked at it, the way the locals looked at it. We looked at the way the Old Testament said about it. And last week we talked about the dominant metaphor, by the way, for sacrifice, and that was the Day of Atonement. Remember, we looked in Israel's history, and they had this weird thing once a year in the fall where the high priest, the official representative of the people, went in and did this Day of Atonement. There was a sacrifice, and there were a couple of animals, and you let one loose in the desert, and you know, things of this type. And we looked at that and said that that was basically one person doing all the work for the entire nation. That was basically the role. And the book, the New Testament, understands that to be the person of Christ, that Christ was both the high priest and the offering of it. So we looked at that last week. The rabbis said, by the way, that if you did not, as an Israelite at the time, if you did not, if you decided that I'm going to sin anyway because the Day of Atonement is going to cover it in the future, that it didn't cover it in the future. In other words, if you didn't celebrate the honor the Day of Atonement, you were cut off from Israel. You did not get the benefits of it. This was sin for the community. Okay, this was the sin for the community. And the Day of Atonement we'll look at when we get to the fact that this was expanded from the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of Israel to the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Okay? It gets a lot broader in this process. So what I've got there under AFR, what was the problem we were trying to solve when we started this? Okay, and I've got six basic problems. There are other problems that are solved, okay? But I'm talking about specifically the sacrificial element of the death of Christ. What were the problems that we were that God was trying to solve here? And I've got six of them listed there. The first one was that God's justice had to be visible for the community's welfare. Now, what that basically means is that God has to show that doing right is the right thing to do. That moral choices do count. That though I struggle on a regular basis against the world that tells me that my doing good and my choices of integrity and choices of honesty don't pay in the workplace, or that the only way to get ahead is to lie, cheat, steal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In spite of this message to the other one, I have to have some confidence that the choices that I make as an individual in this society and this world counts. That when I do right, though it gets busted up, I get my chops busted for it, that it was the right thing to do as measured by some consequences in the future. That righteousness does pay. That God does have a moral order to things. Okay, and so the fact that all these consistent sins of the under the old covenant of Israel and things of this type, the fact that they were never, God never really decisively dealt, blew them away. There were things that in the Old Testament you get these discussions in the Proverbs and Psalms and Ecclesiastes and Job about why do the wicked prosper. It's an age-old problem that we've got. And then we have the answer in the New Testament. The reason is that God is patient. That He doesn't want anybody to perish, but He wants everybody to come to get to know Him. See? God just, He waits longer before He does justice than we would. He's made of different stuff than we are. But there's still that element of justice. They're still saying, how can Habakkuk, how can you judge Israel with this Assyrian nation that's worse than us? How can that be right? That's unfair, God. And part of what this problem is that we have this issue of God has to demonstrate His justice through history. There's got to be some way of authenticating our moral choices. The second problem was that God's blessings were contingent on our basic atonement with the God of the promises. And atonement, remember, is at one mit, just being at one with God. Basically having a relationship with God. So that's a fancy religious word for just being affirmed and in a meaningful relationship with God. God's blessings were contingent upon our basic atonement with the God of the promises. And the way this is structured is that God in the Old Testament made promises to the world that were going to come through the descendants of Abraham. In my devotions now, I'm in Genesis, the quiet times in the morning in Genesis, and one of the promises that God is that He's commenting, He says, I have chosen Abraham so that he will teach his descendants, so they will walk in the ways of Yahweh, so that I can fulfill the promise to Abraham that I made. In other words, he calls Abraham aside, I choose him, I'm going to show what my laws are, what my heart is like. I'm going to show what the right things to do are. And he'll pass it on to the kids, and when his descendants fulfill all righteousness, then I can bless the world through his seed. The promises. I can make the promises back to Abraham fulfilled. And we needed desperately somebody that could keep the law. We needed somebody desperately that could fulfill all righteousness. Because at the rate we are going, and we're going back then, we weren't going to make it. Okay? So there was a desperate need for somebody literally to be a holy high priest, literally a holy somebody to fulfill that so God would be perfectly right in pouring that blessing through. Perfectly righteous in doing it. Perfectly just. Third, we really didn't have anything perfect to offer. That's fairly obvious. I just think about the Israelite that had done some treachery and then goes out to his flock to pick his best ram or his best goat or something of this type and sits there and say, how can this possibly be a substitute for what I've done? I mean, the smart ones, the sensitive ones. How can this possibly be a substitute for this? You know, this thing is flawed. Even though it doesn't have a blemish, quote unquote, relative to the other sheep, okay, it's just not the same thing as what I have done. Okay? We just really didn't have anything perfect to offer to breach this gap. The fourth one is we really didn't understand the seriousness of the problem. We studied last week the Day of Atonement, the high and holiest day of Israel's history. And apart from the mentions where it's given down as law, it is not mentioned again in the entire Old Testament. We have no idea whether they celebrated this or not. We know that they didn't celebrate the Passover on a regular basis because every now and then a king would come along and say, hey, we haven't done this in a long time. Let's have one. Let's honor God and celebrate the Passover. So we have no way of knowing whether they did this on a regular basis or not. There's a good chance they did because it was a one-person ceremony, right? But if you look at the lineage of the high priest in the Old Testament, there's not a lot of confidence in their professional competence. In this matter, if you get my drift there, okay. I'm not saying I would have done any better. That's at all. But I'm just saying that our record of them does not give us a lot of confidence that this thing was celebrated the way God meant it to do on a regular basis. So there's a good chance that we didn't understand this. We still don't, of course, understand the seriousness of the problem. This is part of why the cross and looking at the cross is so strange, because it looks like such an overkill that God would come to earth and die for the sins of the world. You know, when I look at the sins that are perpetrated on me and that I perpetrate on others, I look and say, gosh, that's heavy. That's heavy. You know, I'm not incarcerated, and I'm not, I don't do the spectacular sins that the world would count as spectacular. But that just shows that our measurements are sort of bad. Our measurements are sort of bad. So we didn't have an understanding. We would never be consistent or focused enough anyway. Even if the system was supposed to work, we would never follow through. Our follow through as humans, excuse me, is subject to the second law of thermodynamics. We're always running downhill too, getting worse and worse at this. Habits that the only habits that seem to stick are the bad ones. You got it. Those tenacious stick with us, right? And then our sin destroys community. And when somebody would be treacherous, since most of the sin that God deals with, and we use sin, and there I'm talking about malice or evil. Unfortunately, sin is a strange word in our culture. Oh, thank you, friend. I appreciate it. See, I should be taking that scissors out of the circus peanut thing, shouldn't I? But this boy. Thanks. I lost my train of thought there. Okay. Sin. When we bring all kinds of strange cultural baggage to the word sin, okay? But if you change it to things like a breach of morals, treachery, evil, malice, the words that mean more, because we experience those more, you get a better flavor for this. Some of the words in our English translations of the Bible have lost their meaning to it. Wrath of God. What is wrath conjures up some of the strangest notions you can imagine in our culture, courtesy of Dante and Milton, right? Wrath is moral outrage. That's what wrath of God is. It's moral outrage at how we treat people. You experience this, you read a story about child abuse, you read a story of vandalism against the elderly, you read stories in our headlines today, abuse of people. And if you don't have some level of sense of moral outrage at this, then you aren't alive. Then you aren't alive. Moral outrage. And that's what wrath of God is, So if you're hung up with the word wrath, you look at moral outrage, just because that's what it is. That's what it's about. And our malice and our treachery and our apathy, in some cases, destroys community. And remember, we talked about all the little sacrifices that were to repair those relationships, and then it was supposed to build relationships as well. So that's basically one structuring of the problem that we've got, these six nails. And now we're going to apply those to see what the death of Christ did in those. So let's turn the page. And the first one was, God's justice had to be visible for the community's welfare. And we have a verse that we'll talk about again, by the way, in about probably 2 years when we cover propitiation. But the cross demonstrated his justice, that righteousness does pay, and moral integrity for his creatures. And this is from Romans 4. Whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation, which is a type of sacrifice that was a judgment. In other words, propitiation was something that satisfied God's demands for moral integrity. It was a sacrifice that breached that gap, reset the button, Control-Alt-Delete. Okay? Propitiation in his blood through faith. This was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, the patience of God, he passed over the sins previously committed. So all the sins up until the death of Christ, he passed over in forbearance. Okay? But then at the death of Christ, he publicly did this, 26, for the demonstration, I say, of his righteousness at the present time, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Okay? Point there was that there was an open question as to all these unpaid for sins, and all these things, somehow people had relationships with God, when it doesn't make sense that the blood of animals couldn't do this. And so God said, to show you that I am just, I am perfectly fair about this, I'm going to demonstrate publicly the sacrifice. This is the one that I accept for the sins past and the sins future. So that you'll know that I am perfectly just, and I'm the one who declares you righteous, free from blemish, when you approach me in faith. See, God had two things he had to sort of do here. One, he can't let moral evil go. He just can't say, boys will be boys, let them go. You know, no big deal, they're just kids. You can't do that. Moral outrage says I'll change my moral choices to be like them. See, righteousness does pay. Justice does work. There is a moral structure to the universe that works out. He built it this way, okay? And so he says, I've got to show you that there are consequences of evil. You experience these a little bit in your life, but a lot of people don't. Remember, why do the wicked prosper? Right? There are consequences long term, and I'm going to show these at the cross. I am perfectly just here. Now, the fact that I have done this means that I can come out to you and say, remember where you thought you were going to have to pay for your own sin by good works and all these good deeds? I am just here, and I can let you go completely free. All you have to do is know that I'm a good-hearted God, that it is free, that this is not a trick. There are no T's and C's down here at the bottom of the contract, but you got to get on your knees and crawl 30 miles to the nearest shrine. No clauses here. You just got to be honest with me about who I am and what I did for you at the cross. That simple. That's hard for us to understand because everything else has had those little T's and C's on it in our lives, right? Okay, so it destroys community. It destroys community, and in the case of justice, it shows that God is completely righteous. He is completely just in what he does, and that therefore, when he comes to us and says, you can have this freely, I don't have to worry about him changing his mind later. In other words, it's completely clear and free. The debt's gone, paid in full. Remember that illustration. So that I don't have to depend upon the whim of a monarch or his emotional state at any given moment or my acceptance, because it's written into the law books. I'm literally written in some book somewhere called the Book of Life. And you look up there, it's got Glenn M. Miller, and that's my name until I get a new one, and he's got the new one up there. I don't know what it is yet. Probably Marsh Miller, something like that, opposed to Glenn Marsh Miller. But it's a completely fair kind of transaction. He demonstrates his justice, and Paul makes this point very, very clear. So that need is resolved at the death of Christ, that there is a fairness and a justice that's maintained at the same time that I can get off, quote-unquote, free, because somebody didn't get off free for me, Christ. Right? Somebody took my sin on that substitute on the cross so that I can go free and not have to be up there with him. Okay? The second problem, God's blessings were contingent upon our basic atonement with the God of the promises. Remember, we needed one good human. We needed one good human. We needed one good descendant of Abraham to do this. And if you look at what we've got here, God's blessings were contingent on our basic atonement with the God of the promises. And he opened the floodgates. Our access to God was very limited before this. We talked about this in depth last week. But here's that Hebrews passage. Since therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus. Okay? And we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have obtained our introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand. All right. Now, the way we understand that is that access to the very heart of God was limited prior to the death of Christ. You could, as we talked about last week, you know, there were three sort of rooms at the tabernacle, and you could get to the middle one every now and then, but you only got to go into the Holy of Holies once a year, and that was only one person, right? At the death of Christ, remember, that little veil of the temple is ripped in half. We have free access. The indications that we talked about last week, the New Testament, mean that there's nothing stopping us from approaching the very heart of God. Nothing. In confidence, there's no fear required. It's all been covered. Okay? The passage in Romans here that we haven't talked about much, we have peace with God. See, this is one of the basic elements that drives you. That's what they were trying to do with sacrifice, remember? In those Greek and Roman backgrounds, they knew God was upset with them because something wasn't going right. And that they were going to go buy their peace with God by sacrifices and good works and blah, 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 blah. This points out that we have peace because of something He did, not us. Something He did, not us. And I remember the first time I was trying to struggle some 25 years ago with Romans 5:1, trying to understand, because he's got so many prepositions in this thing. You know, by, for, from, of, does, you know. And I'm trying to structure it all out, use diagramming your sentences, what little I remember of that from junior high. And when we get to our introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand, I ended up coming up with a metaphor of a spotlight. That in a dark stage, and there's a spotlight that shines, and there's a 10-foot circle where you're illuminated. And if I'm standing outside that circle, I'm completely in the dark. And that all the warmth of that light and that sunlight is on that circle. And if I have an introduction into the grace, and that's grace, and I go stand over in the middle of that light, and there comes the warmth, there comes the light, I can see what's going on, etc. And I have access into that grace by faith. Remember, faith is not one of these magical words either. Faith is just trusting God. Nothing hocus pocus here. It's a matter of confidence in God that He's good and He keeps His promises. You know, and that's fairly basic. But that level of simplicity, I get to step over into this thing, the spotlight of grace, this circle of grace, this area of warmth and sunshine. Right? I can either step over to it or not. And what this did was open up, through the death of Christ, that spotlight, that area of warmth and blessing, in a way that there are no barriers to me to go in. I don't have any rituals to go through. I don't have to be a member of a specific ethnic group. I don't have any of these requirements other than go freely. It's like the old, like looking around to see if you're going to get caught, and you run in there. It's that simple. You just think it can't be that simple, but it is. It's simple on our side. Let's put it this way. As we've been talking about, and we'll talk about for a long time, it was much more complicated from the other side, from God's side. The third, we really didn't have anything perfect to offer. This is a fairly obvious one. He came Himself as the perfect sacrifice to ensure its success. Consistently, the New Testament talks about the fact that Jesus did no sin. I remember reflecting upon the honesty of the New Testament writers, and I think about the people, Peter, James, and John, that walked closest with Jesus for 3 years. John the Baptist knew Him much longer as his cousin. And they talk about that He knew no sin. And I think about I was reflecting last night upon college days where I had roommates through the entire my college experience in the dorms and the fraternity house and things of this type. And I think, what are the chances of me ever getting one of them to say, I knew no sin? Right? Chances are slim. And I wasn't brave enough to do any spectacular sin. Remember, mine still are all sort of hidden stuff. Right? Sins mostly of omission, things I don't do but should do. But the chances even of a righteous person, when they say, yeah, they're blameless, say, you mean they don't have any flaws? Well, if you're married to them, that you know that they've got a flaw or two. Right? In other words, but here are people that literally lived, saw Him in the most adverse of circumstances, hostile enemies, compassion, said knew no sin. Long after it's over, it said this was the spotless lamb. And so much stronger is that testimony than anything we could ever scrape up. It doesn't matter how much work you did. You could never match the priceless from God's perspective, the priceless son, the value, right? Okay, four. We really didn't understand the seriousness of the problem. Now, the seriousness of the problem, remember we were talking about, sometimes we would like to understand. We try to see, you know, how things we do destroy things, you know, how they affect our relationships. We see it work its way out in history. But a lot of times we don't want to know. I mean, a lot of times we'll just sit there and be, I don't want to know that I'm doing wrong. I don't want to know what the consequences are. It's like people that sow wild oats and then pray for a crop failure. You know, that kind of scenario. Right? We'll just live in denial and we'll just go do this and try to undo this, right? We don't look at how serious these things are. Sometimes it gets to you. Sometimes there are catastrophic events that happen in your life. You sit and say, wow. Yep, got that one. Did that. You're right. I'm wrong. Can we recover here? And he demonstrated here the seriousness of this problem in our life by a number of things. So if you look on page 16, the things I've got there, just a few of them. The seriousness of this problem, of this breach with God, was demonstrated by the robustness of the sacrificial system. Okay, by the robustness, I mean how many... If the sacrificial system was not robust, this would have been a very short series. Okay? But we had to go through some 12 different kinds of sacrifice to understand how wide this picture was. In other words, to paint a picture of how big the implications are, he had to make a sacrificial system that covered so many different things. Remember, we kept going back, and we'll come back to this at the end, about the four kinds of sacrifices, basic ones that were routine. The one that made a positive statement with God, the burnt offerings, where you said, I'm committed to you, I'm going to give freely. We had a repair one with God, the sin offering. It's where I've breached God, I've broken your law, I've violated something that I should not have done towards you. I want to repair. The one where we repair human relationships, where I've stole something of yours, or things of this type. I'm going to make that good. And then the thanksgiving and the peace offerings, where we're just going to celebrate and build positive community bond. We had those four. And see, that shows part of what had to happen at the cross. Part of what happened. The robustness demonstrates the fact that it's a widespread issue, what we do. The value of the sacrificial victim. Now, the value of the fact that, see, think about this. You could have started with, in the Old Testament, if they were only doing like lambs and goats, right, for the sacrifices and wheat and different things of this type, you could have said, well, yeah, the problem is so bad, we're going to have to sacrifice a whole herd. See, how would you have figured out how big it was going to have to be to really do the job? All the cattle, all the sheep, all the what, right? You may have gotten so far as saying, well, no, we're going to actually have to do maybe people, since they're more valuable than animals in this particular scenario. We might have to have some human sacrifice. What you would not come up with is that, well, God's going to have to come himself and die for this. So you wouldn't have gotten there. You wouldn't have gone that far, because it wouldn't have even entered your noggin that it was this serious of a problem. They would have not even come in there. And so when God comes to earth himself, in the person of his son, and up on the cross, experiences the death that we deserve, and the consequences of alienation from his father that we deserve for this, eventually you back up and you say, this is a bigger problem than I thought it was. Maybe I should take moral integrity more seriously in my life. The things that nobody sees, the things that nobody knows I think or do, maybe I need to be more serious about this. You know, because he sees that, and that's part of what was covered up there. So maybe the value of the sacrificial victim indicates that this is a bigger issue for us to avoid or deal with or something of this type. Our shock at the innocence of the lamb. Now, the fact of that second bullet, the fact that it was God, the fact that it... See, we never... Remember how we discussed about crucifixion? That in Greek mythology, in Greek histories and Roman histories, they would always let the hero get all the way to the point of being crucified. Remember, he was going to go be a martyr. But they were always at the last minute saved from crucifixion. In other words, they never died that shameful death in all of that culture. They would always pull back from this. Somehow they would be rescued. If they were the Son of God, they would come down from the cross. Some would talk them, perhaps. You know? And the fact that, he went through with it. See, because he was innocent. That's why they were innocent and heroes. That's why they couldn't die this shameless death. The fact that our ultimate innocent one did this is a shock to the system. Doesn't fit our notion. Doesn't make sense. It's a violation of our sensibilities. This is not supposed to happen. The righteous don't die this way, especially the most innocent. And so when you said, well, yeah, normally you wouldn't have to, but the problem is so serious, we had to do it this way. You back up and you sit there and say, okay. Then you'll ask the question, what kind of love did it take to do that? The abject shame of the manner of death, that's another one, just similar to the other one. The fact that, I mean, there were other ways to die. You could have gotten stoned to death, you know. I mean, there were other ways to die. And I pointed out back a couple of years ago, actually, in this class, that you could have, Christ could have died for sin up in heaven with nobody seeing it. See, there's no absolute requirement in the fact of the substitution of the sacrifice that it had to be public, per se. Right? Or it could have been just a simple martyr's death in history without the shame and the horribleness of this kind of exposure, a demonstration of this, could have just been a simple martyr's death as a hero, as a king or something of this type, and been a substitute. See? The fact that it came all the way down to the shame level, that this is not only allowed to happen, but is the central message of his followers. Right? The shock there that says that something big is going on here. Something big, because it just... There's some other lessons about that for us as individuals, but it certainly indicates the seriousness of the problem. The need for this to occur before the restoration. Now, the restoration is what we all long for, a new heavens and a new earth in which dwells righteousness, where everybody does what's right all the time. And there's no treachery, there's always love, there's always compassion, there's always somebody to talk to. Community is beautiful, relationship with God, everything. That's the restoration, when it all gets restored. The fact that we couldn't get there from here without going through this Friday. When Jesus said, if there's some other way, can we do that? At the Garden of Gethsemane, the Father had to say, no other way. No other way. You can't get there from here. For us to get to the place where we need to be in our lives, happiness, joy, growing, ability to overcome difficulties, live through the cards we've been dealt with, you've got to go through this. You've got to go through this cross. You don't have to do it, fortunately, but you got to go there. You got to go there and say, you're right. It is catastrophic. It is messed up. Thank you for what you did. I freely take that. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to get off my knees and try to earn this and start drawing upon your strength. The need to occur this before the restoration indicated it was quite serious. You just don't refurb everything. The difficulty of the example of the life. This is one that's particularly strange, the fact that he said, follow me, live as I do, love as I do, and none of us can do this. Right? That's the example of the life. He said, take up your cross, and follow me. Well, when you look at this cross that he bore as the Son of God, his sensibilities of violation of dignity would be so much higher than if you or I were crucified. Now think about this. This is the Son of God, eternally in glory with the Father, right? Comes to earth, rejected by his people, killed by all of them. Somebody up came up last class and said that, somebody had some Jewish neighbors, and the Jewish neighbors were right historically in saying, yeah, we were blamed for the death of Christ, that we killed Christ. Christ killers, they were called in some of the old literature. And I said, they're one-third right. They're one-third right. Who killed Christ? We all did. The Jews did, the Romans did, and Judas was one of us. Peter was one of us. The deserters were one of us, right? Who did this? All of us and none of us, because he laid down his life freely. Nobody took his life from him. So it was all of us and none of us at the same time. See? And the difficulty of following that level of commitment to whatever it takes, I'm going to do for the good of those that I love. Whatever it takes. He steadfastly set his faith to go to Jerusalem. It's one of my favorite verses. Because he's going to die. And he steadfastly set his faith, and Luke says, to go to Jerusalem. Isaiah said one time, I have set my face like flint. Set my face like flint. Well, I don't know the number. Yeah. But if you just do a search on steadfastly, you'll find it. In the NIV or the New American Standard. He set his face to go to Jerusalem. And the difficulty of the example of the life is part of how serious it is. If you've got to do this to resolve love issues, And issues of breach of community. That, again, communicates the seriousness of life. It's difficult for us to do this. Then the fifth one, we would never be consistent or focused enough to fulfill any kind. If God had said, okay, we're not going to do it on a free gift basis, but here are the following three steps you got to do to get to heaven. I remember picking up a track 25 years ago. It said 16 steps to heaven. Literally, 16 steps to heaven. And it had a little checklist there. You had to go through all 16 steps. It's not you pick one of the 16. It's all of them had to be fulfilled, or you weren't going to make the cut. I thought, even if you made it one, if there was an element of consistency or follow-up that we had here, we're going to be off out in left field. We're not going to make this cut. We could never be consistent enough to make this happen. And when you look and see what the answer was, he sent a loyal and faithful and focused and compassionate high priest to do it for us. And the once-for-all character, remember we talked about half-acts, the word half-acts, once and for all in the book of Hebrews. Character eliminated, one, the uncertainty about the future sacrifices. Remember how the Greeks and the Romans, when they would say Jesus, the Lamb of God, is going to take away the sins of the world, they say, well, what comes after that? That's going to cover us today. What's going to cover us tomorrow? Remember? This says once and for all satisfies that. I don't have to deal with what's, you know, who's going to cover my sin 20 years from now, or the sin of the church 2,000 years out or whatever. The uncertainty about future sacrifices, and two, the possibility of our failure to perform consistently forever. Okay. Now, performing consistently, when we talk about consistent performance, like in a job with an employee or something of this type, we don't mean forever. We mean during the tenure of our employment or until they fall the next time, until the next performance review. Okay. And we don't make the requirements like, we talk about like showing up on time over against the requirements of perhaps God, called moral integrity. Or compassion upon those that you don't like, or love for your enemy. See, his requirements for what builds a beautiful community are a lot stronger than what we inflict on others, so to speak. Okay, and we're not going to get there without somebody doing this for us. Okay. Right. And yeah, we sense that, and I think sometimes that's part of pedagogy, teaching. I mean, you know, he has to do different teaching to us, obviously. You know, like I said, the way he rebukes me, it will be different than the way he rebukes you. And there are times, well, like I said, there's an old saying that God speaks to us with a still small voice. And if we don't listen, he will talk a little louder. It's like the parent that starts raising the voice to try to get the kid over in the corner's attention. Till finally, you throw something at him. Hey! Right? And God sometimes has to do this to us. So there are the times that he'll deliberately put us in the foxhole to see if we'll pay attention. And the goal of the foxhole, see, is to get us to where we'll say exactly what Ted pointed out. I shouldn't have waited till I got to the foxhole. The smart thing was to learn earlier before it becomes a painful pedagogy. You'd rather do your regular learning before you get to the graduate school and the school of hard knocks. But you don't want to get over there. You want to do it elementary, your basics. And so, yeah, he will use as varied of ways of teaching us and trying to get our attention as we are varied in that process. So we will spit up these prayers and we'll make vows and say, Lord, I won't do this again. And that's just like a kid would do this. I promise, Dad, Mom, I won't do this again. And you say, good statement. Let's stay on track. And when they do that again the next time, you know, there's still grace and there's forgiveness and you pick up from there. And the final point on the last one has to do with community. And this is the piece that we don't think much about in evangelical Christianity, about what the cross did about community. We know some theology that, according to Paul, somehow the wall between the Jews and the non-Jews were broken down, so we're all one family, one community, things of this type. We know some theological things about this. But we don't, in my opinion, we don't understand this far enough. We don't push this far enough. And I want to take us through. Remember, when we talked about when you did sin in the Old Testament, when you breached it, there were things you had to do repair. There was repair work that had to go up. And when you look at what the sacrifice of Christ, what the death of Christ means to the Christian community. Now, so far we've talked about it's largely relationship between us and God, the substitution for our sin, payment for our penalty, died in our place so we don't have to die. The freedom, he did all the work of bridging the gap so we don't have to do that kind of work. We can take the freeness of this free access. But here in the community piece, I got a couple of notes here I want to make. The first one is that it's a shared sacrifice and builds unity of spirit among those who love and appreciate the loving Lamb. Now, this doesn't show up as much in our Western culture as it does in perhaps cultures in which Christianity is a strong, is an obviously minority religion. So if you are, for example, Christians in first century Rome, you're a persecuted faith. You're a persecuted faith. And it didn't matter whether you were rich or poor, free or slave, Jew or Gentile. If you love Jesus, that's a reason for me to love you and be immediately in camaraderie with you. Our lives were at risk. Our fortunes were at risk. There was a bonding of community that is so watered down by the time we get over here where, you know, it's part of American civil religion, you know, at some level. It's not as predominant as it was, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, but it's still, there's not a bond. Now, you still see it. You'll go to services. You'll go to good churches where the Bible is taught and God is honored, and you'll sense that. You'll walk in, and I call them the four percenters. They're out of every 100 people in the Western Civ, the number's higher overseas, in my opinion. But they're 4% of people that obviously know and love God. They're scrambling to turn around and help the other 96, okay, grow in their relationship with God. But there's 4%, numbers plucked it out of the air, okay, that know and love God. And you are instantly at home with them if you know and love God. You've probably experienced it yourself where you've traveled, you've run across those handful of Christians in your life where you instantly were at home. You know there were huge differences between you. But you knew it. You sensed it in your spirit. And this is what the shared sacrifice was about. The fact that the thing that created our community is the thing we honor the most. Peter says, has one of these most incredible things. It's got to be one of the strongest evidences, in my opinion, for the reality of the Christian truth claims. Because he talks about the Lamb without blemish, and he talks about Christ, and he says, whom having not seen, you love. The second generation, I've never seen Jesus. I've never seen Jesus, but somehow I love him more than life itself. I don't have any other way to explain that. See? Now, if it were just me, I could assume that I'm crazy and it's a pathology. But the fact that there's a wider group of people that have the same disease, right, says that there is that supernatural element to this, that I don't have a way to explain it. I can explain addiction to a cult figure, loyalty, duty, mindless obedience. But I can't do the love. I mean, that's in a different kind of category. There's something specially different about that. And this is what was unleashed, part of this, by the cross. The second, it provokes forgiveness within the community. Under the logic of God forgave, who are you not to? We made a point one time about the history, about the Old Testament sacrifices were not remedies for sin. They were remembrances of sin. They reminded you of sin. They didn't remedy at all. According to the Romans verse, the remedy was only at the cross. God just sort of waited before he cashed the check. Okay? He just waited. Okay? And what has changed in ours is now, I'm already forgiven. You are already forgiven, so there's no reason for me not to. If you approach me and say, I've already confessed this before the Lord, you know I did wrong, would you please accept, you know, my apology? I have no reason under this logic to not do it. I've got to say, well, if you're already forgiven by God, who am I to stand in God's way? I got to do the same thing too. Oh, shucks. I forgive you. Right? And so, this is what the cross did. The cross set that freedom for you out, for you and I out, so that reciprocally, we have a basis already for forgiveness. Similarly, number three, it encourages consideration under the logic of do not destroy those for whom Christ died. If I know that Christ died for you, and that you have participated in that, I have, and you understand that, and if I understand that you are valued that highly in his point, then it doesn't make sense for me to do anything destructive. I will avoid trying to hurt you, logically. If I'm consistent, I will sit there and say, okay, so you're worth something to God too? Okay, so I want to make sure that I don't put a stumbling block in your way. I want to make sure that I don't create a scenario that eats at your faith, or creates doubt in your heart, or creates questions in your mind about treachery within the body or within God's heart or something of this type. I have a reason, the fact that you were part of covered under that cross, to do you good and not ill. I have a positive one. It's actually stronger than that. Because, I mean, I could not do you good. In other words, I could choose to not do evil to you, which is not the same as choosing to do good to you, right? In other words, there's three of them here, right? There's I can choose to not do you good, or I can choose to do good to you, or I can choose to not deal with you at all. Just close you out one way or the other, write you off, you know, etc. And part of the example of the difficulty of the cross, right, is that it doesn't give us this as an option. It's got to go over here, right? But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies, alienated in our minds against God, right? God broke through with this free grace and this goodness, right? Whereas he took a more aggressive stance than what we might opt for in terms of passive disengagement or something of this type. See? So in this consideration, we are urged to provoke one another to love and good works. Remember, we are urged to go out there and positively bear one another's burdens. All the things that you read in the New Testament that we're supposed to do to one another under the guise of what Jesus did for us. The example. Right? And this creates an impulse to do that. Death of Christ for somebody else. I've got to look at them differently. I can't look at them the same. Ever again. You know, you may stereotype them. In our Western culture, we tend to pigeonhole people. But at the bottom line, you got to come back and say, what are they? They're somebody that Christ died for. Just like me. No better, no worse. A value before the person of the heart of God. And God is in pursuit of them too. Okay? I have to be practical in my relationship with them. God tells us to be wise as stewards and things of this type. There are things of this type. But the presumption is aggressive kindness. Aggressive consideration. Out trying to help. Lord, I want to be a blessing to somebody today instead of, Lord, I don't want to be a curse to anybody today. So David said, you know, I made a promise that I was going to keep my mouth shut today. He's got that song where I promised I was going to keep my mouth shut today and not getting in trouble. But then I was around these people, and while I was sitting there trying to keep quiet, the fire was burning inside and I had to say something. Right? And that's the level of impulse that the love of God should have for us in some cases. See, whether it's telling yourself that you need to take advantage of God's love or telling somebody else. You know, they say that that Christians that witness and evangelize and things of this type, you know, almost elitist kind of thing. And I remember the best illustration I've ever had of this that I've ever seen was, no, it's not like that. It's one beggar telling another beggar where to find free bread. It's all it is. Free bread. It's where you can find it. Not working. And I'm not any better because I know where the bread is. It doesn't make me a better beggar. You know, it just makes me full. I get my bread. And the fourth one, see that severe flu thing makes you count off there. It builds shared experiences through celebration of the Lord's Supper and group exploration of the implications of his death. So we go into the sanctuary and we have communion once some period of time. And they'll get up there and they'll read the passage. And about 40% of the time we'll pay attention and we'll reflect upon it. But how rarely do we look around at the other people that were covered by that communion? In the catacombs, you looked at them because it may be the last time you saw this person. Because the Romans might capture them, pour tar on them, and turn them into a lantern in the street and burn them alive. This might be your last night to see somebody that loved the same one you loved. See? And it ain't any different now. You don't know. You know, it's time to show kindness, consideration of those that are covered that share in this brook. And so communion is supposed to build that bonds within us, like it did, the Passover did, and the Thanksgiving offerings and things of this type did in the Old Testament. And so we have to back up and say, no, why are we doing this again? You know, over in the Protestant circles, we don't have it as frequently as other communions do, Christian communions do, because we don't want it to lose its, you know, we don't want it to become ritualistic and where we don't reflect upon it. But we do. But you have to back up and have to ask, if you were, what I do is I picture myself in a cave. When they're up there reading those words about the night before he died, Jesus took the cup. When they read that, I try to visualize myself in a cave with torches and lanterns and legionnaires out there, you know, with spears going to kill us as we walk out. And that these are people that I'm going to have to get to know forever. So I might as well start learning to like them now. You know, I'm going to be with this family forever, so you might as well get an early start on this. And because they all have their stories of how the blood broke into their lives. Just like I do, right? And so this is to build these shared experiences to grow us to trickle down through history as we go forward. And we actually finished the syllabus, if you'll notice. And I avoided having the addendum. I did write up an addendum to bring, but I decided not to do it because we couldn't transport this time. But the point of, overall point here, if we had to try to put it down very clearly, that what sacrifice was to do was it took seriously the notion that we knew that it was broken and that it cost something to repair it. But the message of the cross of Christ was that that way had been, that had all been covered, and that access was completely free to the heart of God. Completely free to the heart of God. And now the issue becomes, what is your view of the heart of God? What is your view? Do you think He's good and approachable and a blessing and a source of freedom and life and life and resources in your life for your day-to-day challenges? Or do you still doubt it? Do you still doubt whether He's good, whether He really cares for your welfare, or just wants to make you into some religious servant or something weird like this, put you on the first boat overseas, right? What is your view of the heart of God? And when you doubt that, you're... When I doubt that twice a year for 15 minutes, I go back to the cross. And I sit there and say, how else can I explain that? I have no way of explaining the love that was demonstrated there for people that are as ungrateful as us. As ungrateful as us. The taunts that He had, Son of God, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. He saved others. He can't save Himself. All this stuff that they threw in His face right there. And what was He seeing? He was seeing your face and my face. He said, nope, not going to let go. Not going to let go. Not going to let go. Going to keep going. And this was the love that just broke through. This is a different message than religion, where you try to religio bind yourself back to God. This is God in pursuit of you. A loving heart, a loving Father in pursuit of your heart to make you smile, to make you happy, to grow you into what you would be proud of someday to be. And be pleased in that process. This is the God that we know, and we only know Him because He broke in the person of His Son. And He left us on all that trail. Without this, we'd be trying to figure out what color God's shell was. We'd be stumbling around in the dark. But He is not as we, and He broke through. So let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we're staggered by the simplicity of this. We want something more complicated. We want something that's more performance-oriented. We're uncomfortable with being honest with You about who You are and who we are, even though there's freedom there, and there's free bread there, that we could somehow appropriate this, that we could always look back at this point in history of this death and the resurrection that show that You accepted this as bridging the gap, and that we could just sort of stop running from You. Give us stronger hearts to see Your love. We thank You so much for the time. Thank You for revealing Yourself to us. And bring us back safely as we come back together in the fall to look at the next element of this, the freedom in Christ, the freedom that comes with redemption, buying us out of the situation we were in. May we honor you this day with our love and our thanks and our goodness and just our enjoyment of Your person in our lives. For Your Son's sake, we pray. Not bad, 5 minutes over.